On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Out of control, where every day is a duel, every life is on the line, and every turn in the road brings you face to face with a new kind of terror. Mad Max. Pray that he's out there somewhere.
Mad Max, the 1979 movie that launched 1,000 imitators and a slew of sequels. The latest, Mad Max Fury Road, up for many Oscars this year. Director George Miller joins us later in the show. But first, a media legend has stepped down. 92-year-old Sumner Redstone has officially resigned as executive chairman at both of his billion-dollar companies, Viacom and CBS. Some saw this coming. After all, investors have questioned Redstone's health and capacity for leadership for a while now. But the conflict continues. Viacom's new chairman, Philippe Dumont, is at odds with Redstone's daughter, Sherry Redstone. She felt the position should have gone to someone, quote, not intertwined in Redstone family matters. Here to shed some light on this saga is Kim Masters. She's host of KCRW's The Business. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, let's start with Sherry. She was the only no vote against Dumont as Viacom chairman. She represents some unhappy shareholders. They're unhappy with what's going on at Viacom. So what does this mean for the future stability of the company?
Well, it's a very good question, and it really is the talk of Hollywood today. Philippe Dumont has presided at Viacom as the stock in the last year has just swooned more than 40%. It's been a tough time for media stocks, but Viacom is definitely on the worst end of that spectrum. You know, Viacom is the parent of Paramount Pictures, MTV, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central. So there has been a lot of shareholder unrest. There's a lawsuit, a shareholder suit that's been filed, just saying that the board is much too cozy with Philippe Dumont. They are allowing the company to go downhill, and it sort of seems confirmed by what happened this morning, which is that they very quickly promoted him to chairman of the company. Now, this is following yesterday when CBS, Sumner Redstone stepped down, as you said, as executive chairman of CBS, and Leslie Moonves, who is a longtime employee, but considered one of the finest talents in the media world as an executive, took that job at Sherry Redstone's request. So meanwhile, over at Viacom, her request that somebody, as you say, not entwined with family affairs should be in charge was just batted aside by this board. Philippe Dumont is on vacation. He didn't even come to this meeting in person.
Wow. So what did she mean by that, that he is intertwined in family affairs?
Well, there are two ways, and Sherry Redstone herself is a member of a trust that will take over the control of these two companies, CBS and Viacom. I am actually unclear at this point whether Sumner Redstone literally must die for that trust to take over, or whether if he is declared incompetent, that would suffice. But there will be a trust that takes over. Sherry Redstone is on it, and so is Philippe Dumont. So that is in one way in which she cited that she feels it's inappropriate for either herself or Philippe to, she didn't specifically say Philippe, but obviously by implication, to be the chairman of this company. The other way is that in this other contentious fight, you know, Sumner Redstone's former companion, Manuela Hertzer, has filed a suit. She was removed as his health care proxy in October, and she challenges that, saying Sumner Redstone was not competent in October to sign that document removing her. So now Sumner Redstone has undergone evaluation by two experts, one for his side, one for Manuela Hertzer's side, and clearly one of the doctors is going to say he was competent, the other one is going to say he wasn't competent. But when she was set aside, and that's for the court to resolve, but when she was put out as his health care proxy, proxy, she was replaced by Philippe Domon. So once again, Philippe Domon is entangled in Redstone family affairs as not only the chairman and CEO of this company, but Sumner's healthcare proxy.
Wow, so that really is intertwined. Let's talk about this empire. It's worth billions, as you said, Viacom owning MTV, Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, Paramount.
Pictures, yeah.
It's incredible. And so what is it that the shareholders don't like Domon's performance, and what has he been doing that they don't like?
Well, they feel that no one is really steering the ship in a very rough seas for media companies. And again, the contrast with Leslie Moonves over at CBS is pretty striking. I mean, CBS has also faced some of these headwinds, but Leslie Moonves is creating, you know, CBS Now, where you can watch this. He's trying to move into the digital age. He still has a lot of hit shows. CBS is still a very strong player, and as I said, I think Leslie Moonves is considered possibly the finest piece of executive manpower in the business. And on the other end of the spectrum, I would say if you took a poll, Philippe Domon would come in kind of dead last if you polled top Hollywood insiders and media business insiders. He has just not been seen as an effective steward of this company. The ratings have been going down drastically. And, you know, you have to counter that one way or another. We've seen Paramount hasn't released that many movies. Comedy Central has lost a lot of talent with Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and has a big setback there. It just doesn't seem that the ship is being steered. And, you know, these proxy firms that advise shareholders on how to vote have voted, you know, have said that certainly at least the compensation committee should have been fired last year. That's what ISS, which is one of the big advisory firms, said, because of the disconnect between Philippe Domon's pay and the company's performance. But that doesn't faze the board.
Well, wasn't part of it the fact that he would have quit and they would have had to pay him hundreds of millions of dollars to fulfill his contract?
No, I doubt that had anything to do with it.
Oh.
I mean, I just think that they really they are wedded to Philippe Domon, and a lot of them are in a position where the pay from this board, you know, runs about $350,000, give or take. And for some of them, you know, there's one of the members of the board is an 82-year-old, attorney. I think that they're all very comfortable with the setup where they get paid and they come to these board meetings and they seem to pretty much rubber stamp anything Philippe Domon does.
Okay, well, we'll see where it's going next. Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of management changes, big news about education news coverage in L.A. today. L.A. School Report is a website covering the city's public schools. It has been taken over by a pro-charter organization out of New York. The editor, Michael Janofsky, was replaced. And now people in the education world here are wondering whether L.A. School Report will become an organ for the charter school movement. Howard Bloom covers education for the L.A. Times. Hi.
Hi.
Well, tell us about LA School Report. It's pretty obscure, but important to education insiders.
Yes, it did not have a huge following, but I read it every day. It covered sort of the nuts and bolts of the school district. It was set up in the run-up to a recent school board election, and it would have detailed interviews with all the candidates. The person who owned and operated it, the founder, Jamie Alter Linton, definitely had a side. She was on one side of the school board divide as opposed to the other, but she did give editor Michael Janofsky the direction to be balanced and give perspectives from all sides, even if she herself was a partisan player.
So tell us about this organization, the 74, that's taking it over. What is it?
Well, the 74 defines itself as a nonpartisan news site on education. It is funded almost exclusively by charter school supporters. Campbell Brown is she's the co-founder. She's a journalist by background with CNN, I believe NBC as well. And she is associated with a number of activist causes in education. The most notable, perhaps, is that she's part of a lawsuit seeking to overturn tenure protections for public school teachers in New York. And she started this website in July of 2015, so less than a year ago. And she definitely is a partisan player. The site claims to be, and by the way, partisan in education does not mean Republican or Democrat. It just means the sides are mean something else. But mm-hmm. partisan means you have strong opinions and you want a particular agenda. And you know, it's a hotly debated thing in education. And she is on one side of this. And she writes a lot of opinion pieces. I mean, if you look at some of the what they call news pieces on the site, some of them are well-written, well-edited, and they have diverse perspectives. But critics claim that the overall thrust of the site, if you look at it in its totality, is to push people in a specific direction.
And that specific direction is in favor of charter schools.
Well, that would be part of it. The other thing that critics say is that they want to find fault with the traditional public school systems and public employee unions, and some of their funders have an agenda in that direction, although not all of them. So, I mean, you know, it's not how they define themselves, but people who looked at the critics who've looked at the content define them that way.
So why would they want to come all the way out here to Los Angeles? Why would they be interested in this relatively small website?
Well, it may be a small website, but it's not a small place for education debate. LA has the second largest school district in the country. There's a defining battle going on right now between, you know, over the growth of charter schools in Los Angeles. LA has more charter school students, 101,000, that has the most of any school district in the country, and more charter schools. And there is recently a proposal floated that would have sought to raise money to put half of LA school district students into charter schools, which, if it went forward, a panel of experts said could threaten the solvency of the school district. So these issues are being fought out in LA, and the kind of students that are in Los Angeles represent the future demographics of the country. So there are plenty of reasons for them
to
be out here.
Right. And Eli Broad is a big player in this. Is he involved in any way in the funding of either one of these organizations?
No. Actually, I do not see him listed as a funder. So, we will not know. We may never know for certain who all of their funders are, but as far as the funders listed on the website of the 74, he is not on them. But I should mention here, he is a funder of some of the Times, LA Times, education coverage, and that has raised concerns for some critics as well.
Right. I mean, this article that you wrote on this very topic today in the paper has a paragraph-long disclaimer at the bottom explaining the funding, and that one of the funders for education coverage at the LA Times is the Broad Foundation.
Right. I mean, I think that it is important for readers to scrutinize this closely. I think the LA Times should never be given a free pass on anything. It's too important. It's a major media outlet, and this is a reason why readers should give us additional scrutiny. That doesn't mean we're guilty as charged of doing anything biased or in our reporting on a particular story or our story selection. But I do think reader scrutiny is appropriate at all times, but especially when you have funders who fund a portion of the coverage who have a stake, a viewpoint in this debate. Now, there are some distinctions between the 74 and the LA Times, which I can go into if you want.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay.
I mean, there are probably lots of distinctions.
There are lots of distinctions. I mean, the Times is almost entirely funded by advertisers, right? And these advertisers advertise in the Times hoping it will sell their product. And there's a complete division from the revenue-raising portion of the paper and the editorial content. But papers have had a hard time making a go of it financially and maintaining the size of their staffs and the breadth of their coverage. So they've explored getting funding from other areas, not just the LA Times, but other places as well. And the Times, by the way, also gets a grant from the Ford Foundation for another area of its coverage. Now, in this case, the Times accepted these grants, and this was under the leadership of former publisher Austin Buettner, for a portion of the education coverage to expand the education coverage. And the actual terms of the grants say that the Times retains full editorial control over the content of the coverage. So far, so good. But again, you still have to, you know, as a reader and as reporters here, you know, we are concerned, my editors are concerned about not doing anything in reality or appearance that would suggest that we are beholden to anybody. And during the period of the grants, we've written some very tough stories about the Broad Foundation and its activities and the Charter Schools Association and former Superintendent John Dacey, who is a favorite of both. Now, mm-hmm. I, and now... I should say that the, just to finish the close the circle here,
yeah.
The 74 was created just to cover education and funded entirely and fairly generously by advocates of a particular perspective in the education debate. So it's the difference between a mainstream organization that's taking a slice of funding that maybe it should or should not take, but you have a whole culture of not being influenced by that funding here, versus an organization that was kind of funded with a partisan. Well, it was funded by a major partisan in mm-hmm. the debate, and founded and funded by other partisans
right.
in that debate. Now they defend their quality of the work and say, judge us by what we do. And some people have looked at them and say we like their work. Other people say, well, guilty as charged.
Okay, well, we'll see going forward. Will it be called LA School Report or the 74?
As far as I know, it's going to be still the LA School Report. Well, one thing we've noticed is that there is some content from the 74 already on the site, and not all of this content is even bad. So, I mean, some of it is quite interesting, so we'll just see how that goes.
The old wait and see. All right, Howard Bloom, covering education for the LA Times. Thanks.
Sure.
Coming up, Shani Jardin is here to talk about what's making waves on the web this week. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Social media is at the top of the tech news this week. And to talk about that and some other juicy e-news, I'm joined by Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hi.
Bringing the internet juice.
Bringing it.
Plugging okay. it right in.
Let's talk about Twitter. So there was this article in The New Yorker that basically proclaimed the end of Twitter, and then everyone else said, no, it's not the end of Twitter.
Well, that's the point of a ponderous think piece in The New Yorker, is to posit something controversial, get lots of clicks, and then have
you
everyone else
cynic.
Generate traffic
you cynic.
By arguing with you. Yeah.
Well, so the idea was that Twitter's growth has stalled. It's never going to catch up to Facebook, so it should just, you know, throw in the towel and become more like a social media site?
Well, that's just not what happens when you have millions and millions of dollars and lots of investors and lots of very passionate users. So the article talks about cracks in Twitter's facade, that after this kind of amazing growth story where we saw massive events of massive civil unrest in the Middle East and then right here in America made visible in ways that we just never would have been able to tune into the revolution before, that after those profound world-changing experiences that we had on Twitter, it just seems to be kind of falling apart. Like the writer talked about it being a rudderless organization. Now that Jack Dorsey is in as the CEO, there are questions, you know, like, can Dorsey really lead this company? Does the company know what the company wants to provide and to whom? This is sort of pull it together or die moment for Twitter.
Wow. Well, one of the things I think that is being debated and fiercely debated is whether or not Twitter should go like Facebook with algorithms in terms of what you see in your feed rather than a strict chronological timetable. What do you think of that?
Twitter Moments was their that was their off-Broadway way of testing that. So Twitter Moments was a way that Twitter could look at whether curated human algorithm, maybe a combination of both, content would be something that people would gravitate to more than that. It's really kind of old school, just like blogs used to be this reverse chronological. You see this post and then you see the post before that and then the post before that. It's very nerdy, the idea that you just want to have access to all of that data. Well, this other design philosophy is really good for making internet companies lots of money, and Twitter wants that.
Well, so who's going to decide whether that's going to happen or not?
We will.
Oh.
We, the users.
Okay, good. We have some power left. That's good to know. Okay, so moving on, speaking of big social media platforms. Mm. Instagram is going to start running a scripted series today. It's called Shield 5, and it features five internet stars. And they're going to run 28 15-second episodes over the course of a month.
This is super interesting to me. This is kind of like what we have been talking about for decades with the internet. I can remember sitting at the Directors Guild in West Hollywood and hearing people like, you know, William Gibson and the hot directors of the day debating about what kind of storytelling technology we would be using when television and movie theaters became less dominant and other forms of media interaction yet to be invented rose to the top. That's what's happening here. So with this series, they're talking about uploading, as you said, these very short video clips, but also still images that might tell important parts of the story. And I loved the... I'm usually so jaded about new buzzwords that come out, but they're using the term social cinema.
Hmm.
I think that's kind of a classy
little
buzzword.
The alliteration.
Yeah.
Sounds good. But will that actually work? I mean, can you actually get a fulfilling experience in 15-second bites?
We don't know yet. And Snapchat tried this with a serialized TV-like experiment. These are sort of moonshots. You know, these are more of them are going to fail than are going to succeed. I think part of it depends on how much the audience already cares about the story, and this is already very well established.
So it's not just a PR stunt.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is, but it's also R&D for the future of entertainment, whether they're smart enough to know it or not.
Okay, let's talk about what's happening at Oral Roberts University. This is a Christian university, and they want to make sure their students are living the clean life. Mm. Everyone in the freshman fitness course will be required to wear a Fitbit that's linked to the school's grading system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of me thinks, okay, yeah, it's a fitness course. You should monitor if your students are fit. But there's something creepy about that, too.
I'm not able to get on there's something creepy about this bandwagon because the contrarian view is always the one that I orient myself towards. All right, look, not all students at this Christian university, despite what your aunt says on Facebook, not all students at this Christian university are required to wear digital monitoring devices. It's students who are part of the physical fitness program. Like, to get a passing grade in this program, you've got to do 10,000 steps a day and a certain number of hours of activity a week. That's a very reasonable requirement. How would you measure that? A Fitbit is a great way to measure that. Does the Fitbit also capture, you know, your heart rate, your innermost thoughts?
Your GPS, where you are at any given time?
They're not going to capture that. They're not going to share that is what they say. So here's the thing. The Internet of Things, these wonderful wearable devices, the Apple Watch, the Fitbit, I love them all. They do capture lots of data, and how we access the data, how we share it, those are the questions. Like, these devices are just going to know all sorts of things.
Well, how do you know, if you're a student at Oral Roberts University, that the administrators aren't collecting all this other data?
Come on, we're talking about a conservative Christian university. Like, there's tons of stuff to be outraged about on the internet today. This is not one of them.
Okay, let's move on then. Speaking of personal privacy, Laura Poitras, Astro Noise, opens at the Whitney in New York tomorrow. She's the activist filmmaker known for that documentary Citizen 4 about Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. So tell us about this show and why you're excited about it.
I should disclose first that I am on the board of an organization called Freedom of the Press Foundation. Laura Poitras and Edward Snowden are also on the board of this press freedom group. So the title Astro Noise, I just feel like the title says it all. It refers to this this sort of energy flittering around in the universe after the Big Bang. It's what Ed named the encrypted file that he gave to Laura and Glenn, that encrypted
Glenn
file.
Glenn Greenwald.
Excuse me. Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, who mined that Big Bang of information to find all sorts of sensitive documents that are of great interest to the American public about the NSA that violate our Constitution, that violate American law. So what Laura Poitras is doing with the remnants of that Big Bang in this exhibition, it's hard for people to get really emotional about data leaks. So she's creating art with this data. So I just think, from an activist point of view, from a news point of view, from an art point of view, this is a really cool thing for anybody to be doing, let alone somebody who was also instrumental in making this information available to news organizations.
And what does it say to you that this is taking place at a major American museum?
Well, it means it's a very big deal, and that everyone in the country has now heard about or thought about something involved in that big bang, you know? Like, who even knew what NSA stood for five years ago? And now this is something that everybody, like, we don't know what the answers are, but we know we ought to be concerned. And art is a great way to get people concerned.
Are you going to go?
Oh, I am ready to go. A couple of the other board members on the foundation are going. I am ready for somebody to take me in their private jet tonight.
Okay.
Out of the Santa Monica Airport.
Do you hear that, everyone? Open invitation.
Feel free to put me in your hoverboard and take me off to the Whitney.
She'll be wearing her Fitbit, though.
Yes.
So we'll be able to track
you. So the NSA can track me.
Yes. Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right. Do you think Twitter is on its way out? What would you want to make it better? Would you watch Instagram's 15-second TV show? Let us know your thoughts on tech at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on the web at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. That's our Twitter. Coming up, the creator of the Mad Max movies is here. George Miller talks about making an accidental feminist movie and how the original Mad Max was kind of an accident, too.
To be honest, it wasn't post-apocalyptic for any other reason than our budget was so low that we couldn't afford to shoot in busy contemporary streets.
George Miller on what his latest Fury Road is really about. That's next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Oscars are at the end of the month, and nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, and in eight other categories is Mad Max Fury Road.
Imagine! Imagine Joe! He looked at me! He looked right at me!
He looked at your blood bag!
He turned his head, he looked me straight in the eye!
He was scanning the horizon! No, I am awaiting.
I am awaiting in Valhalla!
George Miller, the man responsible for that movie and the previous three Mad Max movies, also won an Academy Award for the Penguin musical Happy Feet.
It's just one big old foot after the other. That's it.
Ooh.
Yeah, see?
Well, that feels good.
You don't have to be beautiful.
Yeah, man.
To turn me on.
Well, George Miller is here now in the studio. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you.
Well, so the Mad Max franchise, the Happy Feet franchise, two totally different worlds. Is one an antidote to the other?
I guess so. One's a holiday from the other. But they have a lot in common too, even though it might not be obvious. I mean, they're both pretty kinetic movies. One's dance, one's action. But also I like playing with the new toys and tools of filmmaking. And Happy Feet was one that arose out of motion capture. A dear friend, Andrew Lesney, who shot the Babe movies, went on to shoot the Lord of the Rings movies. Mm-hmm. And he came back from the first one and showed me the first motion capture of Gollum. And the moment I saw motion capture, I thought, we can make these penguins dance. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
And Fury Road was an opportunity to work with new technologies. The cameras are getting so small, they're digital cameras and so on. So there's overlap.
We'll talk a little bit about the new technology in Fury Road. The film is, well, it's famous for a lot of things, but especially the scenes of the actors being on these gigantic poles that go back and forth. And it looks pretty dangerous. And I believe Max was on one of them for real. Tom Hardy was really on one of those poles. It wasn't CGI. How did you make that?
Well, there had to be a way where the assailants were able to board this big war rig that's racing through the wasteland. And so I remember seeing some street performers on poles, a little bit like the pole vaulters have, and they were stuck to the ground and they were swaying in the breeze, as it were. I thought, if we could get something like that on a vehicle, maybe that could work. Plus, they could use them for lookouts and so on in the desert. But I didn't think that we would ever be able to do it for real and keep everybody safe. I thought we'd shoot the guys on the poles and then comp them in digitally into the moving vehicles. But we had a wonderful stunt crew and rigging crew and special effects guys and whatever, and they made it work. And they made it work so well that it was safe. So we were able to get Tom Hardy up on top of it. And it wasn't until he actually got up on top at one point that he said, "Look, I'm afraid of heights." And I said to him, "Do you have, one or two takes in you?" And he said, yeah, we'll give it a shot. But he didn't like it because you're up there, I don't know how high.
It looks
30 feet on a pole.
Yeah.
But those guys stayed up there, all day. They were circus performers. They felt very, very safe. And it lends a certain spectacle to the movie, and it's logical within the story.
Yeah, absolutely. So you said about your first Mad Max movie, which came out in 1979, that Mad Max was B-movie filmmaking with A-movie aspirations.
Yeah.
What do you mean by B-movie filmmaking? And is that true about your other Mad Max movies?
Well, it was interesting. Back then in Australia, in the 70s, there was there was this tremendous enthusiasm for making movies. There wasn't really a career to be had in cinema. And people were making movies and the government was subsidizing them a little bit to get them started. But they were all pretty low budget. But most of them tended to be period dramas. Somehow it was Australian filmmakers catching up with Australian history through cinema. But then there was genre filmmaking. And I'd made a couple of shorts, but I really wanted to make this action movie, a car chase movie, which is pretty much genre, and it was very fast, cheap filmmaking. But I thought if we could really treat it quite seriously, like really think a lot about the film language, the syntax, and so on, because I was very, very interested in the silent cinema. Because that's where the film language was forged, particularly the films of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and all those, the Max Sennett movies and the two-reeler westerns and so on. They were virtually all action movies, chases of some sort, and they could only exist in the cinema. They weren't of the theatre or any other form. And so Mad Max arose out of that, and I was always fascinated by the kinetics of it, them all, and how it's like visual music. And so I guess that's what I meant, that it had those aspirations. And it was really Fury Road that I really got to do it in the way that way back then I felt it would be an interesting exercise to do it, to almost a continuous chase, and to see how much you could pick up. How much subtext, how much about character, the relationship between characters, the world, and so on. Without a lot of dialogue. As Hitchcock said so wonderfully, he tried to make movies where they don't have to read the subtitles in Japan. So they're like silent movies with sound. Of course, his movies had a lot of dialogue, but the idea being that the visual language helped give you, the audience, the experience. And and that was the exercise in Fury Road. And you don't really know until all the little bits of the mosaic are together that if it really does play, if the audience does have that experience.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with George Miller. He's the director of the Mad Max franchise, including the latest, Mad Max Fury Road, which is nominated for 10 Oscars. Now, you have said that you're planning two more Mad Max movies. Is that true?
Well, this film looks pretty helter-skelter and rambunctious, but in order for it to be coherent, we had to dig down right deep into the subtext and create a really, really strong shared internal logic to everything in the film. Every bit of design, every vehicle, the way that language is used, the gestures used, and so on. So in doing that, every single character, we had deep, deep backstory. And the world, even though you only see the surface of it, things are alluded to. You might see places from the distance, but we had to know what those places looked like and how they arose out there in the wasteland 45 years after some apocalyptic event. So in doing that, we came up with other stories, and we're talking about them. Right now, it probably won't be the next thing I do, because I want to do something smaller and faster to kind of, you know, cleanse the palate, as it were.
The antidote.
Yeah, the antidote. And the antidote, yeah.
Are you surprised by the very strong positive reaction to having a very strong female protagonist in a movie like this, which, you know, the genre is dominated by male heroes?
I knew she was a great character, because if not in the writing of it, the way that Charlize took it on, it was immediately apparent that she was very powerful, Furiosa. We shot in more or less in chronology, and there were times when I'd be watching her, and even when we'd finish shooting, sometimes when we'd pull up the big war rig and everything would come to a stop and there would be a break, she'd often go walk into the desert a certain way just to get away from all the noise, and I'd see her there, and she felt so appropriate to the place in this wasteland. And so I knew something was really interesting happening there, but I didn't expect that people would pick it up to the degree that they have. That character arose out of story. The story evolved organically, and there's no feminist or political agenda. We just had to do our work, even though people like Eve Ensler and others, you know, were involved in the workshopping, just as we had
the playwright Eve Ensler.
Who's done an enormous amount of, you know, work helping women in Africa and other places in the world. Anyway, I knew something was there, but I'm surprised and I'm delighted by how people have picked up on it.
Talk a little bit about how politics or world events figure into these Mad Max movies, because the first one, 1979, I guess you could argue this was made against the backdrop of the Cold War and fears of a nuclear Armageddon.
Well, the first one was a smaller story about a cop, and to be honest, it wasn't post-apocalyptic for any other reason than our budget was so low that we couldn't afford to shoot in busy contemporary streets. We couldn't have other vehicles. We couldn't block off streets. We didn't have the location fee for normal buildings. So we went to the most derelict buildings we could find and the most deserted back streets we could find. And we shot the movie. And I thought, to explain this rather hyperbolic story, we began with opening credits that said a few years from now.
Yeah.
Now, when the film was eventually released around the world, it had much more resonance than I had ever expected. This is the first Mad Max. And by the time we got to the second Mad Max, The Road Warrior, we were much more aware that we'd sort of tapped into an archetype, a universal archetype in the Max character. The interesting thing was that the beginning of Mad Max 2, it talks about two tribes going to war basically over oil. And that was triggered by the OPEC oil crisis way back in the earlier 70s, where in a really benign, placid city like Melbourne, Australia, and there were severe gas shortages, it took 10 days with people queuing up for the first shot to be fired. it wasn't someone that fired a gun, not at anyone in particular, but there was so much sort of stress in these lines. I thought, wow, it's such an easygoing city like that. If it takes 10 days, what happens if it's 10 years? So that's the logic of that. Now by the time we get to Fury Road, they talk about the oil wars, but there are the water wars. And it was about 7 or 8 years ago, I was in India, where they were talking very much about water wars at the border with Pakistan, where, you know, there were severe water shortages. But the films themselves aren't really speculating about a future. It even though it's 45 years hence, after some series of apocalyptic events, you go back to a more neo-medieval time where the world is much more simple and the rules are much more simple and the technology is much more simple. So they become sort of allegories, really. A little bit like the American Western, I think. The allegorical stories, very simple figures in the landscape. And that's always interesting because you can tell very simple sort of morality tales, I guess.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, that's a great pleasure. Thank you.
That's George Miller. He's a writer, producer, and director, the mastermind behind the Mad Max movies. His latest, Mad Max Fury Road, is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Warren Olney is here now.
That's pretty good music to be introduced by.
Marching
band,
I know.
Whoa. All right.
Lead us.
Here we go. Well, we're going to New Hampshire, and things are getting pretty lively in New Hampshire. We have Ted Cruz saying that if Donald Trump got elected, he might nuke Denmark. And we have Jeb Bush.
Wait, who's going to nuke Denmark? Cruz or...
Oh, no. Cruz Trump. Is accusing Trump.
Oh, okay.
Of being
just
a guy who
that.
Would
yeah.
nuke, who guy we couldn't trust. And, of course, Trump is accusing Cruz of having stolen the election, caucuses, I should say,
in Iowa.
So it's getting very lively. We'll have a very interesting conversation about where they all might be going. And you know, does Rubio really have the support of the establishment? What about those governors, you know, who are still around, including Jeb Bush?
Yeah, what about them? Yeah, Rubio getting an influx of cash after
cash,
Iowa,
yes,
so that's
and an endorsement from somebody who can't remember what his achievements are.
Details. Warren Olney coming up at 1 o'clock, so stay tuned for that. And coming up on this program, the Super Bowl is this Sunday in the Bay Area, and lots of people there are pretty grumpy about it, and we'll tell you why next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. This Sunday, Super Bowl 50 will take place at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara. But the week-long party leading up to it? San Francisco. The city is hosting lots of activities. There's the interactive theme park known as Super Bowl City at the foot of Market Street. And there, fans can play interactive video games on huge outdoor screens. Alicia Keys and other big names are performing. And because this is San Francisco, there are also protests. Homeless people have been moved out. Some vendors have been displaced. Joining me now to talk about all of this is Nato Green. He's a comedian and a columnist for The Examiner. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Set the scene for us. Describe this Super Bowl city. What does it look like?
Well, I haven't been through because it's all police checkpoints. We tried to go over there on Saturday with a protest against the police murder of Mario Woods, and were stopped by a line of riot police, and there's cops everywhere in downtown with machine guns to protect Super Bowl goers from protesters, I think. So... my understanding is that Super Bowl City features $8 Bud Lights and a zip line and some other stuff. It's not particularly well attended because it's not that cool.
So it's not for the residents, you're saying? It's for the visitors.
It's definitely not for the residents. Also, there's been a big spike in sex trafficking and prostitution, as a result of the Super Bowl. So there was just that the police has had to ramp up their sex crime squads, and there's like whole banks of rooms that have been rented out for prostitution to service people coming in Super Bowl. So,
but to be fair, doesn't that happen at every Super Bowl?
I
mean, maybe you haven't seen it up close, but.
You're right. I haven't seen it up close. It seems curious to me that a mayor would willingly invite a surge in sex trafficking into their city. But, I don't understand how people in City Hall make decisions.
Well, City Hall has decided to spend nearly $5 million on these parties. What do you think of that? And what about the idea that that money could be offset by tax revenue coming in?
Well, I mean, this just happened in San Francisco. Just a few years ago, San Francisco hosted the America's Cup, and we were promised all kinds of permanent jobs and all kinds of great tax revenue, and there was a bad deal negotiated, and it was the progressive supervisors that were like scrutinizing the deal, saying that it was going to be financially beneficial to the city. They had these incredibly optimistic projections from the America's Cup. Of course, it didn't pan out. There was nothing in the agreement that to hold the America's Cup for the city's exposure, and the city ended up on the hook for $30 million to have a vanity event for Larry Ellison, the Oracle CEO, whose personal net worth fluctuates about $30 million a day. That's the average daily fluctuation in his personal net worth, and somehow the city had to cover that out of tax revenue. So, they come in with these super optimistic projections about how much it's going to benefit the city, and super conservative projections about how much it's going to cost the city when they present the deal and plan for it, and then at the last minute everything changes and there's nothing to be done. And so, and meanwhile the mayor is saying that we have a budget deficit. And we have to cut programs and services and pensions to meet the need. So it seems so irresponsible that the city didn't learn a lesson that it should have learned 3 years ago for immediately the next comparable event.
Well, it's not that San Francisco is not a football city, because the Niners have had some amazing games that have brought the city together. And you are a lifelong San Franciscan. You were around back in the 80s and 90s when the Niners were on fire.
I watched the 1990 Super Bowl when the 49ers played the Broncos from a comic book store at 23rd and Mission. And at the time, there was like the heyday of the Bay Area thrash funk music scene. And so next door was an old Victorian where the band The Limbo Maniacs lived and had a four-bedroom flat for $900 a month. And when the 49ers won massively, they put guitar amps on the windowsills and started playing music into the street, and there was a spontaneous mosh pit in the street of skaters and cholos and celebrating. And that kind of authentic spontaneous public encounter of people who are different from each other and can respect each other and learn from each other and share public space, that's the opposite of what is happening now, where everything is commodified and packaged and produced. And if you are not, that's what the sharing economy means, is that every bit of possible private life that could be turned into something for money is, that there's no shared public space or community that isn't part of making somebody rich anymore.
So what you're saying is what's happening in San Francisco this week is just an extreme example of what the city has become all year round.
Absolutely. I mean, San Francisco has become basically like Disneyland's Main Street with tattoos. And $4 toast. It is a city that is not for the people who have lived here. It's a city that is where those people are in the way. It's a city for rich new residents and tourists. And if you are not a part of that, then you are going to get policed or evicted out of existence.
Okay, let's say you want to come to the city and you don't want to participate in all that stuff. Do you have any tips for anyone this week?
San Francisco has always been I like that San Francisco has always been welcoming to all kinds of people. And I just wanted to continue to be welcoming to all kinds of people, not just people who want to make apps, but also people who want to get away from Central American death squads, and also people who want to go to gay bathhouses and have sex with everyone. I want everybody to be able to come together and have a community. And we have less and less room for anyone who is not making apps and being rich. So I welcome everybody who wants to come to San Francisco. I just want them to be cool about the existing communities that are here and not try to impose their worldview at the with the help of the police on everybody else. A lot of people who, like me, who are natives who grew up here, people walk around feeling like screaming all the time. I've sort of snapped on people in public recently.
Like strangers?
Yeah. I was in line at a taqueria, and there were a couple of hipsters in front of me, and they were complaining about how, like, San Francisco has great food, except there's no authentic, gritty, down-home barbecue. And I tapped them on the shoulder, and I said, excuse me, I grew up here, and 30 years ago, there was a lot of great, authentic, down-home barbecue. Here, the names of, you know, Brother-in-Law's and Moselle's and Big Nate's and Johnson's and Pittman's Pit, and all that stuff is gone because in that time the black population went from 13% to 3%, and when you destroy a community, you destroy all of the small businesses that support that community. And they were like, hey man, we just want a horchata, you know.
Well, good luck this week.
Thank you. There are protests all the time about homelessness, about the police, about the 49ers using non-union security guards. There's a welcoming protest at the SF airport on Saturday. There's a roving block party of the People's Block Party. So that, to me, that's the real San Francisco. Yet last night there was a homelessness protest where the police told people that they were going to arrest people if they set up tents on the street, and so there were 1,000 people holding tents in the air so the police couldn't arrest them.
So San Francisco still lives.
Yeah, we're not going out without a fight.
That's Nato Green, lifelong San Franciscan. He's a comedian and a columnist for The Examiner. Nato, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we'll end it all with Julie Myers. Not it, not the big it, but the show.
Yes.
With the listener
Spend your
feedback.
Final moments with Jolie and Madeline on Press Play.
What a way to go out.
That's right. Well, grumpy San Franciscans, you know that I collect grumpy people, so I loved this comment from JP Collins on Facebook. He says, my city spent $5 million for this corporate marketing NFL-themed exhibit known as Super Bowl City, and all I got was this lousy 3 weeks of blank show, commuter traffic, and blocks of walking around the damn thing to get to where I'm going. Thank you, JP. I love your grumpiness. You win today. We also had a tweet from Baby Puncher SF that just says, send help, please. Los Angeles to the rescue.
Okay. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. And that'll do it for us at Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.